He, him.
My name is Kay Ross, she, her.
And you're listening to Watch Out for Fireballs. It is a Games Club podcast special event.
Yes, this is one of the rerun episodes we promised slash threatened that we would do. Talking about The Legend of Zelda. This is an episode of Bonfireside Chat from when we were filling time before Elden Ring. And we think it's a good episode.
Yeah. It's if I recall, a patron asked for this. Is that correct?
I don't know.
We might have just decided to do it.
I think we just decided to do it. Yeah.
Because it's not something that we talk about this in the episode. It's not an explicit influence on Dark Souls, but it is.
Yeah, you can't.
You know, like they say that it's not, but like, yeah, it is.
You can't get there without going through. Yeah.
Yeah, like it's the foundation for a lot of the genre markers.
Yeah.
There. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole host of Bonfireside Chat episodes that will appeal to you, the Watch Out for Fireballs listener.
Mm-hmm.
Let this be a taste.
Yeah.
No, they're not that different than our Watch Out for Fireballs episodes.
Yeah.
They're just for things that are tangentially related to Dark Souls.
There are a bunch of them waiting for you there. And since all we know how to do is a WAF, they are they are just multi-part WAFs.
Yes, or single-part WAFs.
Yes.
Some of them are just one. Mm-hmm. This is just a one.
Yeah.
Some of them are indistinguishable.
Mm-hmm.
So we figured we'd rerun this. It'd be weird if we got through the history of Watch Out for Fireballs without The Legend of Zelda 1.
Right. If we just... Yeah, and this is recent enough that, like, you know, we talk about recording these rappers with, like, new thoughts. I don't know that I have a lot of new thoughts about Zelda.
No, Zelda's steady.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, there are going to be people who hear this and they're like, well, I already listened to that episode. I listened to Bonfireside Chat. Mm-hmm. For that, you know, I apologize. As we said last year during the thing, this is just so we can take time off for the holidays and shit.
Yeah, we're also just not supposed to apologize.
That's true.
This is resurfacing. This is resurfacing a lost classic. We're bringing it to more people. You have more people to talk with about it. You can send this to people. This is not just a useless rerun that you have to ignore. No, we impel you.
Yes, give it a re-listen, even if you listened to it before. And Zelda rules. It's fun to talk about. It was fun to revisit.
Yeah,
game holds up. It was really cool. So yeah, check it out. Enjoy. We're going to do a little end wrapper as well, where we have a shout out. Mm-hmm. So stay tuned for that. It's a cool one. And thank you for your grace and happy new year. And we will see you next week to talk about Thief or talk about Guppy.
Explicitly not. Oh, no. Yeah. Don't talk about Guppy.
We'll talk about the Guppy transformation, I'm sure. Okay. Talk about the Binding of Isaac.
Mm-hmm.
So enjoy this and enjoy that. And thank you for your listening. And if you want to support us, go to patreon.com/duckfeedtv. You can get all those other Bonfireside Chat waffle likes.
Yeah. I'll make a note to make a collection of those.
I think Gwen has already done it. I think that's something I asked Gwen to do early on in her career with us.
Excellent.
In fact, I know that there's a Bonfireside Waffs spreadsheet that she made.
Cool.
Some of our landings were desperate adventures. We are now prepared to meet the inevitable counterattacks with power and with confidence.
We'll be right back. This is Gary Butterfield.
This is Cole Ross.
And you're listening to Bonfire Chat. It is a favorite to everybody.
Yeah, and this week we are doing a very special episode. We are covering The Legend of Zelda, which is an action RPG developed and published by Nintendo for the Famicom in 1986 and the NES in 1987.
Yeah, and you know this. You're playing a weird little green fucked up man.
A little fucked up man. Yeah, your little sword made of wood and your pointy hat.
Yeah, what's under what you little... little pathetic little wretch.
What you hiding under that pointy hat there?
Yeah, God's own creature just farting his way to the beat off bonanza. This little kid sucks.
What makes you keep coming back?
Yeah. What are you looking to prove, little man? She's not gonna date you. She's not gonna see this, bro.
Mario
has been need to go through The Legend of Zelda. She ain't gonna see this, bro.
Mario has explained this to you.
Yeah. Oh. There are a lot of Vertical Horizon-esque video games on the NES in the 80s when it was about trying to get a girlfriend. You know?
Yeah.
Kind of weird. That's what made Metroid such a twist.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we all know this stuff. You're Link. You're a young hero. You had to collect pieces of something called the Triforce to rescue Princess Zelda and defeat an evil pig wizard named Ganon to save the kingdom of Hyrule.
Yes. Did you know that Ganon was originally supposed to be a vampire?
I did. I saw that when I was looking at this stuff. Yeah. I never thought it made sense that Ganon was a pig.
And it always seemed kind of weird to me.
Yeah. I understand that he has a lot of like pig orcs,
right?
You know, kind of troops, but the way that Link is constantly just killing animals is very strange.
just casually, callously, yeah. just yanking wings off of the Tektites. Yeah. Hey, Gary, why are we covering this on this show?
This makes tons of sense. It's dumb that we haven't done it before.
I know.
There have been action RPGs before this.
Mm-hmm.
This is not the first. You know, because we're covering an old game, whenever you cover an old game, you run into the like game historian trap of ever saying first.
Yes.
And then somebody like pouncing on you and talking about it like a Japanese PC game by Falcom that did it slightly before.
Right.
But this is, you know, meaningfully the first.
This is, you know, it's like
on console.
Archetypically on the console, and it is a shared touch point for a lot of people, not just at the time, but also because it became this whole long series. It has kind of only grown in importance as time has gone on.
Yes. This is recognizable to the entire genre.
Yes.
You know, of action RPGs. This plays like an action RPG.
Yeah,
does for something, and every action RPG, whether consciously or unconsciously, as is the case here, owes a debt.
Yes,
to this.
Yeah, laid out a lot of design tropes, right? It kind of in the way that Adventure on the Atari laid out design tropes. We could have covered that. I'm glad we didn't. This is more interesting.
Fun to play.
No, yeah. So, in doing a search around this, just to see if, you know, this is a stated influence on Dark Souls, found an interview that Miyazaki, the designer of Dark Souls, did with Rolling Stone, and it's really interesting. He says, and I think that he's denying the comparison mostly out of modesty here, but he said, when I was a student, The Legend of Zelda was truly monumental. So to be perfectly honest, I feel deeply unworthy of the comparison. If there are similarities, they probably stem from the fact that The Legend of Zelda sort of became a sort of textbook for 3D action games.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a, not to, you know, tell Miyazaki what is going on in his head, but there was, I'm certain that there were bits of this that came through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it was through that textbookness, but also just because, of course, he played it because everyone played it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's very obvious It feels, it's like when we did Hollow Knight and they're like, you know, we didn't, there's no Dark Souls in here. And it's like, I know that we're just two people who exist, but I don't know if I believe you. Like it's a, you know, it's a deeply insulting thing to straight up tell somebody like, oh, you're, I'm not, I don't think you're lying. I just,
no,
you know, if so, that's fucking weird.
Yeah. And I understand to a certain point, like, I don't know. It kind of seems like that would be, it seems fair for that not to be a thing that you want to say yourself. Right. Like, yes. You know, I'm not going to draw the comparison because that might sound arrogant, you know, saying like, we're going to do Zelda here. And implied in that is, oh, we're doing it again because we're going to get it right this time. Right.
Yeah,
or,
yeah.
You know, so, something to that degree that can be for other people to say.
Well, and there's also the basicness level of it as well. Yes. Right. Like where it's like, you know, if you play rock and roll music, mm-hmm. you know, like you are indebted to pioneers of rock and roll,
mm-hmm.
you know, and whether you are like, oh, I actually listen to them or not, you are following in the footsteps.
Yes.
Like it doesn't, you're not trying to do it better or anything like that, mm-hmm. but you just happen to be, you know, reading from the same book that they wrote.
Yeah. It's quite literally a trail that's been blazed. You know, you are designing around, you know, questions that have already been answered. You know, like, how do I depict a world larger than one screen, right? You know, a fair amount of the manual actually, like, explains, all right, when you walk off of the right, you're going to appear at the left of a different looking screen.
Like, yes, yeah.
Yeah. So, that, you know, we don't consider that to be, you know, a problem that had to be solved, but it, you know, but it was.
It did.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a, you know, and all those things have... You know, somebody did it first.
Yes.
Right. And it's not quite Zelda, mm-hmm. but, you know, close enough.
Yeah.
There's a reason we're talking about the original Legend of Zelda here and Ocarina of Time gets relegated to watch out for fireballs. Yeah. You know.
Yeah.
Worst comparison there.
Yeah. As the series goes on, it becomes a weaker and weaker comparison until you get to something like Breath of the Wild. Which is a conscious return to the original, you know, some of the spirit of the original Zelda. Yeah. You know, and there are, you know, there have been Souls comparisons made on Breath of the Wild as well. But the reason we're making this comparison in the original is because you are set loose. And, you know, this is the one you are set loose, given zero guidance how to navigate this hostile world full of mystery.
Yes. Secrets.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually I started thinking of, when you talk about those later things and it's less of a good comparison, it's worth underlining that in that I think when I think of modern game Zelda games prior to Breath of the Wild, they're actually kind of my poster child for getting wrong everything that Dark Souls gets right.
Yeah.
It's not just that they become it becomes less of a good comparison, it becomes a good anti-example.
Yeah.
Like when Dark Souls came out, it was refreshing because there wasn't a you know, a Navi.
Yeah.
Like that was a selling point, was that they didn't do the Zelda thing of like, you know, if you want to live and you have to breathe, tap A to breathe in and tap B to breathe out.
You know, what a nightmare.
Walk by putting one foot in front of the other. You know, it wasn't this, it was really refreshing to have something that didn't do Zelda shit.
Yes.
And for better or worse, like I consider that stuff Zelda shit.
Mm-hmm.
It is the thing that I hate about the series in its, you know, fully 2/3 of its fucking entries.
Mm-hmm.
Like no. It is mostly a bad series, I think. with a couple really good games.
Right. And when we say like Zelda shit, we're really talking about Eiji Aonuma shit.
Yes.
Because that isn't that, like, that is a design kind of hallmark of his. He is, you know, he really dislikes putting players in a situation where they will feel lost. And that is why, you know, any Zelda game pretty much after the 2D era, but like it even leaked into some of the 2D stuff a little bit. It starts kind of being a bit more sweaty, a bit more anxious about pulling you along on this string.
Yeah. Nervous DM.
Yeah. And yeah. The concrete starts hardening, you know, around this. Whereas in the original Legend of Zelda, kind of feels like anything could go.
Yeah, it is. It's confident.
Yeah. And there's another quote from that Miyazaki interview that I thought was pretty neat. Comparing the ethos of Dark Souls to Zelda, I think indirectly, but him saying our goal was to allow players to do what they want, to define their own goals, make their own discoveries, embrace their own values, and find their own interpretations. Core to that was the importance of getting lost. This gives value and meaning to finding one's way, which is a great way to put it.
Yeah. And it happens in Zelda 1.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't unrisky when this happened in 2007. Miyamoto gave a talk at GDC and talked about how Japanese players found it very difficult, you know, to navigate this open world mm-hmm. that they had. And kind of to patch over this, and again, this is the Dark Souls-ish shit, people work together.
Yeah.
So when, you know, similar to, you know, Miyazaki, you know, his car story of pushing cars up the hill mm-hmm. in the snowstorm, people would share secrets and stuff that they found in Zelda 1. And then the developers kind of embrace this idea.
Yeah.
Like that's something that is core to both, even though we're going to talk about it in terms of like an actual expression of that idea. The secrets here are way worse.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And there are multiple factors that go into that, you know, memory limitations and localization stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep, yep. This is very similar to how From embraced this with the wiki, the FromSoft wiki for Dark Souls that they hosted. And they want the community to collaborate on Souls as well.
Or even built in with the soapstone system, right?
Yeah.
You know, I think that something that's pretty big is the ability for characters for people to lie to each other and embellish mm-hmm. and make guesses as well. And the fact that that was built in and From feels, you know, it feels in line with this. Feels in line with
Start player phantoms as well.
Yes.
You know, as this this kind of idea.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, something that we kind of allude to as Zelda has kind of strayed away from this, the original Zelda has only become more relevant over time, primarily because it set out with this openness and with this mystery, and as other genres that had openness and or mystery kind of became more common, you know, open world stuff and Souls and things like that, and even back to, you know, Breath of the Wild, the original one has kind of had this renaissance and become more relevant over time.
Yeah, it's aged really well.
Yeah.
It's aged better than its followers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in 30 years, whatever the equivalent of Bonfireside Chat is, won't be talking about Spirit Tracks. You know, just like...
When I was looking around, I came across the Zelda timeline, and I saw Spirit Tracks on it, and I got mad.
just the Zelda timeline makes me upset. It's so contrary to what they should what this series should be, especially revisiting this first one, mm-hmm. which is the first time I replayed the first one in a long time.
Yeah,
and just it did just make me upset about the state of Zelda pre Breath of the Wild.
Yeah.
And I still think Breath of the Wild has a little bit of, you know, there's room for improvement even there.
Of course.
But it is a step in the right direction.
Yeah. Sure. And I mean, something that I didn't kind of call out here, but I think is very important. Like all the story in the text is in the manual. This is not a talkie game. You know, it is important to find people who will tell you things in this. Like that is a way that information is conveyed. That is something that you go to and see, and it doesn't stop you from doing anything.
Well, it's also just another comparison to the way that the information is conveyed in game in Zelda mirrors the East-West translation obfuscation stuff that happens in Dark Souls.
Yeah.
You know, this localization is generally all right. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole book about it.
Yep.
The localization of this game. They're cryptic.
Mm-hmm.
Like the things that people say are cryptic sounding.
Yes.
And that to me, that mirrors almost like a reverse way the reading Fighting Fantasy.
Yeah.
You know, or, you know, reading Sorcery.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff that the Miyazaki did, where like I'm getting this translated version of this hint and I have to try to make it work.
Yeah.
You know, that's really interesting. And the story, as opposed to being item description stuff being in the manual, is kind of what we had at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The thing they have in common is the story stuff is still the general text of it is largely supplemental.
Mm-hmm.
Be it either in game item descriptions that you have to piece together or in a separate book.
Yeah.
you got with the game.
Mm-hmm. And kind of another part of that is like everything here feels hostile. And that I'm going to qualify that by saying there's no like town that you go to. There is no bastion of civilization in this, no Kakariko village, Hyrule town, yes. Things like that. This is all wilderness. Calling this a kingdom is actually kind of weird.
Yeah. I don't know I don't know where these people get, food and sundries.
Yeah.
Who made your clothes, man?
It feels more similar to the Forbidden Land and Shadow of the Colossus to me, honestly.
Yeah. No, that's a good comparison.
Yeah.
For sure. And then it ends up, again, tying into Breath of the Wild, which has Dark Souls and Zelda 1 things. That was my big issue with that, is that's a post-scarcity paradise.
Yep.
That is portrayed as an apocalypse.
Yeah.
So basically how Zelda works, like a lot of people know this, but it's worth kind of talking about some of this stuff. It's top down. It's 2D. You navigate screen to screen that make up the overworld with an 8x16 grid of screens. And then you go into dungeons that are underground that are an addition.
Yes.
To this.
Yeah. Your primary attack is your sword. You don't have to pick up the sword until the until the very end. Yeah.
Yeah, you can go without sword. That's a challenge run. Also, the original version of this had a choice between the boomerang and the sword.
That's wild.
It's so interesting, uh-huh. Right? Like, do you want to be able to kill tough enemies with a low range thing, or do you want a long range thing that can only stun them?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, different styles of play. Like stunning them lets you get away. There's nothing saying you have to kill them unless you are on
until
a screen.
You get to the dungeons,
right? Unless you're on a screen where you have to kill them. Yeah,
that's where. Yeah, I think that's where this choice kind of fell away. They realized that. Their dungeon design, the stealth wasn't going to be an option, basically. But that when I read that, I was like, oh, that's really cool. Mm-hmm. That would have been an awesome idea.
Yeah.
This starts a thing where this is true in the Zelda games. If you have full health, you throw your sword, mm-hmm. which kind of shoots a little beam.
Yeah.
Later this becomes just something that's unique to the Master Sword. But being able to shoot a beam when you're at full health introduces a cool risk reward.
Yes.
Part of this game and series.
Yeah. You're much more powerful, when you are at full health. One yes. basic thing about the sword that feels pretty important, in the original, like you don't do a swipe. It is just a straight up stab. So you mm-hmm. like aiming and positioning are more important. And also yeah. like you kind of take this for granted, hitting enemies will knock them back. And yeah. getting that space, especially in crowded rooms where, the enemy AI is mostly either move randomly or seek you, managing their distance from you is a pretty big deal.
Yeah. Yeah. When they also introduce, if you are facing an enemy, you have a shield to block projectiles when you're facing them. You don't do an action for this. Enemies have this as well. And there is a weird little aspect of reflex to Zelda 1.
Yeah.
Like a move I was consistently doing, which was a quick turn and stab, that I didn't really realize I was doing at first, like what yeah. exactly was happening. That kind of like ties a little bit of like skill-based combat
mm-hmm.
to this that also felt, you could make ties to a Dark Souls.
Yeah. Yeah. It's especially when you're going up against the Dark Nuts, the knights yeah. who have the shields, you end up doing a little dance with them. It's more explicit in Zelda 2, which I fired yes. up just when I finished the original. I was like, I want to play some Zelda 2. And I got about halfway through it. That is more explicitly, when you get up against those, against the Dark Nuts, that is more of a sword duel, attacking high and attacking low, in order to get them. That is more explicit. That is still present here. And it's wild how they were able to kind of capture that dance with this real basic movement and attacking.
Yeah. Unlike Dark Souls, this is not an RPG. You don't get upgrade your stats, but you do upgrade your sword and your shield.
Mm-hmm.
And your health or your defense values.
Yeah.
And your health. Like there are elements of avatar progression as well, mm-hmm. To this without it actually having straight up stats.
Yeah. Yeah. You've got secondary, treasure. You've got treasures on your little subscreen there, that either have passive uses, like your ladder that will, create a little bridge for you over one block gaps. More frequently you get the kind of the sub weapons that you do, your bow and arrow, your bombs, these things that have become, just part of the DNA of action RPGs.
Yeah. Yeah. in addition, you get some weird things. You get like candles, mm-hmm. you know, things like that that don't show up later
yeah.
in the series, but are also really interesting. One thing that I really like about Zelda 1 that I was thinking about mm-hmm. in terms of an economy or modern action RPGs is the way that they abstract arrows.
Yeah.
To just cost money, which at first seems like kind of a cheat, but it's also almost a shorthand for you going and buying more arrows.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it almost feels like a player kindness, you're sending something back to the village to buy them. You know, and they just abstract that whole thing.
Like Torchlight?
Yeah, like Torchlight. Or just like, oh man, I went and got more things. It just doesn't make you do it.
Yeah, yeah.
What if there was a JRPG like that? When you tried to use a potion when you didn't have one, it just took from your money.
Oh God, what a kindness.
Yeah, I understand why they don't do that, because what mechanics would they have
uh-huh.
if they took away their preparing for the dungeon? Like, that's what that genre's got. But the it was an interesting idea.
Yeah,
like thinking of it as an actual economy that was being abstracted.
Yeah, when I tried this as a kid, I was like, oh neat, he's tying his gems to sticks and shooting them.
Yeah, yeah. I also thought you were somehow doing that.
Yeah,
you know, which I suppose you could do. They are the sharp little,
oh you know, yeah,
little things.
But you're going around and trying things on the world map will often get you heart containers. This is a pretty big deal because your ability to upgrade your sword is pinned to your maximum health. This is it rewards exploration because you know you want to jump that curve because you're only going to get one additional heart container at the end of each dungeon, yes. and you're gonna need more health than that.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. There is money. As you mentioned, there's kind of an economy in this. You get rubies. They're called rubies in this, which is probably a reason for that.
Mm-hmm.
Them giving their own little bespoke name. It might have been a mistranslation, mm-hmm. you know, or just like a sound alike on this. And you buy things from shops.
Yeah.
In this game of a sort. Or gamble.
or play the money game. Or pay to repair doors.
Yeah. Yeah. Or pay for just like god awful hints.
Of course.
We talked about the manual for this game. That's where you're going to get most of your kind of guidance on the narrative of what you're doing. The manual is really good. It has a lot of unique art.
Yeah.
In it.
I love that style. And this is, I love yeah, the chunky little Link.
Yeah, I love I need a fat Link.
It's doing the box art thing, depicting what happens in this game, in full art, so you can supplement your imagination. This is especially cool with the monster designs, you know, getting the cartoon versions of the monsters, which in this low pixel kind of style can be pretty abstract.
Yes. Looking at it and learning about the kind of history and struggles of Hyrule, I was really surprised Impa was around this early. I'd forgotten that.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, oh, that character wasn't just made up.
Yeah.
Or later lesser games.
I mean, lesser. The first time I remember her showing up was in Link to the Past. That's a good game.
Yeah. No, that is a good game. She just gets a way bigger role.
And then she becomes like an Amazon warrior lady. Which is a strange turn. Why not? Yeah. So the manual spends a long time explaining the basics of play. They really want to belabor the difference between the main screen and the subscreen, which is pretty clear. They do a good, they do something neat with this, because the top of the interface when you're playing the game is your like little info sheet. When you press the button to go to the subscreen, it actually slides down. So it's not, you know, like you're going into a new room where all the characters are text or whatever. It's actually like a piece of paper sliding down and you're making your menu choices. It's a good,
kind of mirrors going screen to screen.
Yeah.
Just in navigation as well.
Yeah. Then it starts describing navigating the world, you know, using the various items, and then gives strategy tips for the monsters. Most importantly, though, and I think more, you know, most useful for anybody who is just now sitting down with this, is that it does tell you how to get to the first two dungeons, and gives broad hints about how to look at the others. When I sat down to play this, I just fired it up on the Nintendo Online. right? The their little backward compatibility service or what it is. And I was like, ah, God damn it. I forget where the first dungeon is. And I like poked around and I was like, okay, I know there's a heart container here. There's, you know, X and Y there. And I realized a person just firing this up, unless they rented it from a place that didn't have the manual, would not be lost. I'm not experiencing this the way that somebody in 1987 would have. So then I pulled up the manual and the PDF and I was like, ah, there we go. Like that gets you started. It gives your momentum.
I actually think that having that stuff, and you know, it also includes like a 70% of the map for the overworld. Mm-hmm. I actually think including that stuff weakens a little bit the Dark Souls comparison stuff.
Yep.
Like just a little bit. Like it is, in terms of it being a player kindness, like yes, it is good to show you where the first dungeon is. But it doesn't, that idea of being lost and just searching around for the first dungeon and accidentally stumbling into a way later dungeon.
Yeah, stumbling into like stage six. Oh no.
Yeah, way more Dark Souls than it is to actually have this guide.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm kind of surprised, you know, I can imagine somebody in the first half of this episode, us talking about this and somebody be like, no, you have the manual. It's not the same at all. Part of it is you have to kind of look at this and squint to make it match up as well as it does in a couple ways.
Yeah.
In other ways, it's, you know, the comparison lands. Mm-hmm. I ended up having to do that for later dungeons.
Yeah.
And it's worth as a caveat, that I ended up looking up stuff for this with some frequency.
Yeah. No,
you know, that I didn't remember. And that goes more into how secrets are hidden in this versus how they're hidden in Dark Souls, which we'll talk about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also made liberal use of the rewind feature. Because I didn't feel like going and farming for the rupees to go and buy health potions and stuff. If I can just make it so if I don't screw up that particular screen, it just makes it easier.
Yeah. It's not like I haven't played this legit many times.
Yeah.
So, the dungeons, as we mentioned, you can go in almost any order. This is more of like a challenge idea, you know, for challenge runs, like going to the graveyard. This is really, really difficult. You are underpowered and you're new at the game. You don't understand it. Ending up in dungeon six is a huge problem.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like, I'm here. I'll give it a shot. And I was beaten, pretty quick. Yeah.
Unlike a Dark Souls, there's very little advantage to be had.
Yeah.
In doing this, you're not really getting, oftentimes you're not getting more powerful items.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you can.
Yeah.
But in general, you're not. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the differentiation between how secrets are handled.
Yes.
In the two, because it's largely a function of just the eras, which they came out, and the graphical fidelity. But one of the reasons why I didn't feel bad using guides for this is because even though this has a lot of comparisons with Dark Souls with how obscure it is, you know, the third bush from the right, you burn it to find something. There's no visual indicator.
No.
I love the way secrets are handled in Zelda for that playground aspect. I don't like how they're handled in a vacuum because there's no telegraphing.
Right.
In any of them. Is there anything in game to suggest to you what you should do to find these secrets? And I think that is in a vacuum is pretty bad design.
Yeah.
And is noteworthy in how it encourages collaboration.
Yeah.
Between people.
You know.
There's a little bit of that, like we just covered Super Mario Brothers 3 for WAF, and a little bit of that, like, how did anyone come up with this stuff? And I know the answer to that in this. In that, it really feels like a bizarre intuitive leap. Mm-hmm. In this, somebody, you know, accidentally burned a bush and then decided to burn every bush that's in the entire world.
Yep.
You know, they Wolfensteined it. They humped every wall.
Yeah.
And without something to kind of show you, you know, later with more fidelity, they could do things like, oh, this looks suspicious.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the way Dark Souls did that was really elegantly. Like, you get up to the top of the tree in Blighttown and you see, oh, this treasure chest doesn't have anything good in it for something that looks this momentous. Mm-hmm. There's got to be something else to it. And then in Zelda, they decided to make it, oh, this wall has a big, obvious crack on it.
Right. You
know, they decided to make it go way too far the other direction.
Yeah. My favorite, my favorite concession on that was, I think it was in Link's Awakening, where there wasn't very much of a visual indicator, but if you tapped your sword, it would make a different sound in a part of the wall that could be blown away.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
And then like Link to the Past does both.
It does. Which is strange.
Yeah. Very strange.
Yeah. Like the big part of like brute forcing this, because all of these could be solved with pressure and time. But the big, you know, the big constraint is mostly bombs. You can only carry so many of them. You can pay later on to get the, to get your carry capacity upgraded. That's a
smug piece of shit. I bet you like more bombs. Yeah. Yeah, I bet you suck my dick, you old man. Like, you bet right, you piece of shit. You want this kingdom saved or not?
Oh man. So you know, you're only carrying like 8 of these things at a time, and they're, you know, relatively rare. You know, once you buy them, they'll start dropping from enemies, but you know, that's added to a pretty scant drop economy. So you want to be pretty careful.
It's the rarest drop.
Yeah.
The actual mechanics of how they're dropped is a big part of speedrunning this game.
Yeah. It becomes a little bit more intuitive in dungeons, where you can, by looking at the map, see like, okay, there plausibly could be, a room in this place. Like that is an empty space that is not reflected on the map. Maybe I can bomb this particular wall over here and give it a shot. Yeah. And it's always going to be in the center. Whereas on the world map, it's kind of anything goes.
Yeah. Yeah. There are kind of hints. You'll run into people, you know, who will give you these very oblique hints. Sometimes they just lie to you. Mm-hmm. We talked about a book about the localization. There's a book called Legends of Localization by Clyde Mandolin.
Yeah.
That talks about this.
Yeah.
Stuff. It's a really cool book. Recommended.
Yeah. It's a great book. I want to take away his exclamation mark key. He fixed that by the time he did the Earthbound localization.
That is a good point. It does feel a little like Stan Lee, like it went through a Stan Lee pass.
Man, the Earthbound book is fantastic as well, and he scaled that back, which is nice.
So some
of the caves will either like directly reward you or penalize you. We have the money game where you gamble. You know, mm-hmm. that can put you again ahead of the cost curve on stuff, buy more expensive things, or sometimes you blow open a wall and then there's a moblin in there that demands you pay him to repair his door, which is a wonderful little bit of comedy. This is kind of it's a cute. Funny game.
There are a couple of funny bits,
yeah,
in it for sure.
Buy something, will ya? Yeah,
yeah, will ya? I suppose. Again, yeah, it's Kingdom Save or not. There is a key economy in this. Keys are transferable in this, unlike some other games in the series, and you can buy them. We're quick shout out to the Boss Keys series by Game Maker's Toolkit on YouTube, who went through and analyzed every Zelda dungeon and every Zelda game.
Oh, nice.
Really good. He's wrong about a lot of stuff. He has this weird thing where he just kind of played through all of them in order. So it gave him this weird Stockholm syndrome for the water temple, I feel like.
Because
a lot of the Zelda dungeons are actually pretty crappy.
Right.
For a series that is, you know, that's the reputation it has, is that the dungeons are good. Like when we did Ocarina, I was kind of blown away by how tedious a lot of those dungeons are.
Right.
You know, not just the water temple, but just a lot of them in general are really tedious.
Yeah.
You know, and if you're just, and a lot of them don't actually have a concept to them. Mm-hmm. You know, they just have this weird illusion of nonlinearity and stuff. Yeah. So when you're face to face with that, you're really, you know, water temple seems like a fresh air.
Yeah.
To him. But the early entries before he got totally pilled by the later shitty Zelda games are really fun.
Yeah.
So.
What happens so much later, you know, what happens in the later games, I think, was a visual impressiveness, right? And then also, you know, atmosphere kind of acted as Vaseline on the lens. And
I mean, that's exactly it.
Yeah.
When people say that the dungeons in Twilight Princess are fantastic, that's what they mean.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it's not the actual dungeon design. It's just it feels cool.
Yeah.
And there's something to that, but it's less valuable just to me personally as a subjective thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And it gets less valuable over time as well.
Yeah. It's harder to revisit. It's worth noting too, the dungeon of this game. I don't know if you got a note for this. Another Dark Souls, comparison to this is that this game is atmospheric.
Mm-hmm.
The dungeon, you know, they actually, while having this kind of dungeon design as well, the music and kind of vibe of the dungeons is very atmospheric and foreboding.
Yeah.
In this game for being an 8-bit game. It's kind of surprising.
Mm-hmm.
It's just what they do with color palette and music, but they do a good job of it. It reminds me of dungeons in Dragon Warrior.
Yeah.
One, which are also like pretty atmospheric.
Yeah. I also like that the axis on which dungeons get more difficult is mainly by size. Right.
Yeah.
So you need to survive in this longer. You know, there'll be new enemies, but those kind of taper off. You know, they will start throwing more of them at you in a room, but it kind of becomes, you know, a little bit about the hostility of extending further and further into dangerous space. And yeah. Will I be able to get out? You know, if stuff respawns behind me, will I survive the way to the exit if I need to break in the middle of this? Yeah.
That's the elegant half of how they scale up difficulty in this game. The inelegant half is just, here's a big pile of random dudes.
Uh-huh.
You know, we had sketches of salvation. Here's four random units on the middle floor. Like,
yep.
What about, you know, dark nuts, bats, and slimes? I don't know. You know?
Yeah.
Like, let's just throw some guys in here. Just, you come in, they're having a party. Like, they're all just like walking around in random directions in the dark.
Uh-huh.
Until you get there. You light up the torch and it's like you walked down that hotel room in The Shining. With a dark nut. Just like, oh, sorry, no. I'll go. I didn't realize you're having a bat slime dark nut party.
I'll come back later. You could have put up the do not disturb sign.
Yeah, put a necktie on the door next time, dark nuts. I won't come in. But the encounter design in this is primitive and not good.
Yeah.
In the way they scale up that difficulty, that ended up being the, in terms of like actual frustration,
mm-hmm.
You know, in terms of, because this was a surprisingly fun experience just to revisit this.
Yeah.
The last couple dungeons get annoying.
Yeah.
With how spammy the encounter design gets.
And also,
and that's very contrary to Dark Souls.
There's a certain monotony to it as well. You know, like a lot of the rooms are functionally very, very similar to each other, yes. You know, not just within a dungeon, but across all of them. And, you know, some of the shine came off of the apple around like stage 5 for me when they started getting a little bit more tedious.
Yeah. And that's still fine. And then just gets really frustrating the last couple, like 8 and 9 are annoying.
Yeah. Yeah. There's New Game Plus. Not the first time. Second run could be made after you beat it where things would be harder. We're not going to talk about the second quest in detail, honestly, because it's a remix, you know. This is, you know, a place, and it's funny how they it's funny how they came up with this too, because the dungeon designer just accidentally only used half of the memory that was allocated for dungeons. And like, okay, well, like, we have a surplus, we have to use it, I guess. So why don't we change things around in the second quest or another Zelda was born?
It's very generous.
Yeah.
You know, philosophically, just to be like, you know, we can make this cheaper, but why don't we make it better instead?
Yeah.
You know, I like that quite a bit. In the new quest, there is a very Patches-esque development where a character says, leave your life or your money, and you have to pay money or lose a heart container.
Uh-huh.
That's wild.
Yeah.
I love that so much.
One of the most meaningful upgrades you can get is just hand it over, but if you don't have the money.
Yeah. Your money or your life. Like a classic.
Oh. And there are two other kind of big deals. These don't necessarily fall under the New Game Plus, but these are parallels, because, you know, that happens all the time in Dark Souls. Challenge runs, like we talked about with the swordless run up to a point. There are also challenge runs where you can do, like not get the upgrades, you know, neither the ring nor the low extra hearts. Swords. Yeah. Low hearts, things like that. And a major one, like the first major randomizer that I heard about, randomizer mod was for Zelda.
Yeah. And apparently the Link to the Past ones are really fun.
Yeah.
I've never fucked around with that, but apparently they're very good.
I know Riff watches those a lot. So
yeah. So this game began development in 1984. Shigeru Miyamoto designed the game. Takashi Tezuka wrote the story and the script.
Mm-hmm.
Miyamoto bases his games on childhood experiences in general, and this came from exploring the woods near Kyoto and finding a lake he wasn't aware of.
Yeah.
That's a real little kid
mm-hmm.
thing, when the woods wasn't just a place to find, you know, dead homeless people.
Right.
It was a place to get lost and have exciting times in.
Yeah. And I still try to recapture that. I still go walking in the woods.
It's a hard thing to recapture. I watched a YouTube about a guy, just YouTube suggested to me, who lives in a hobbit home he made for $5,000 a year.
Oh, wow.
And it was to recapture that feeling of the woods. And it was really appealing for a second. Like, I'm not going to do it because I'm, you know, I die if I'm not touching my phone every, you know,
yeah,
1 minute
yeah.
out of every 10. But the, for a second, I was just like, what if I went and became a hobbit person?
Maybe.
It's real similar to my sea person.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Thing I've been having, like if I became a water person or a ground person.
Yeah.
It's becoming, leaving this urban lifestyle and switching to another element.
No, it's like me wanting to become a mountain person or a forest person, you know?
Yeah. This dude is a forest person who lived underground.
Yeah.
You know, and it reminded me of that. And the thing that I thought of that was really cool was that, not only is this guy recapturing this, but if this guy, you know, were to abandon his weird home, how cool would it have been to be a kid and find like a door on the side of the hill that was half open and you open it, it's full of like books and stuff.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Like the coolest thing that could ever happen to you as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, assuming it didn't end real darkly.
Right. Cause something will live there. Like
a witch coming back or something like that. Like assuming it didn't end with you being baked into bread.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, sorry. They cut off my feet to use as talisman ingredients. And to crawl back to civilization. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, do you want the good news or the bad news? The bad news is they're not running any marathons anytime soon. The good news is the local bog hag can fly because my feet have been ground up and into a paste and put on her broom.
Yeah, she snorted. So, she snorted a lot.
Yeah.
My feet.
She bones. Snorted a lot of my toe blood. So,
Oh, man. I didn't realize Zelda was designed concurrently with Super Mario Brothers. And I saw that and I thought about how young Miyamoto must have been at the time. And I've got real depressed.
It is like some of the most, you know, momentous.
Yeah.
It's just like huge impact on the world, you know, this medium.
It's Dolly Parton writing Jolene and I Will Always Love You on the same day.
Yeah. Yeah. Every once in a while it happens.
Yeah.
Yeah. Originally, this was going to be a Mario game.
Yep.
Called Mario or Adventure Mario.
Yeah.
Where Mario would walk around and do this shit. That's interesting.
Doing very un-Mario things.
I'd be into it, man.
Yeah.
I think I would have dug that. Like I like Zelda and stuff, but it just the idea of our fat little man walking around bonking things with a wrench. Like I'm pretty into it.
Yeah. Yeah. I would be curious to see more of those documents and see like how far, if at all, they got down that road before they decided to, you know, go in the fairy tale fantasy book direction. Right.
Yeah.
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 So the two of these being developed concurrently kind of led to them being foils for each other. So as the teams came up with ideas, they asked themselves like, okay, is this a Zelda idea or is it a Mario idea? And thinking about them in that way, and thinking about the contrast between them, that is a very interesting, kind of conversation, I think, that is between those two works, linearity versus non-linearity, reliance on items versus reliance on momentary power-ups, that kind of deal. Kind of the only similarity between the two of them is a lack of emphasis on score.
Yeah. Yeah. Even though, like, Mario did have a scoring system,
yeah,
and a time limit, all those things. When you think about the three pillars, I also found that, you know, this next point out when I was doing research, you know, Zelda was going to be futuristic, have time travel. They thought of this idea that early the Triforce was going to turn out to have like microchips in it, and shit, be like a silicon thing from the future.
Yep.
When you think about the three pillars of Nintendo games, you have your traditional fantasy with Zelda and sci-fi with Metroid, and it makes Mario seem so fucking weird as like the third option, as a genre.
Yeah.
Like, sci-fi fantasy and like, dude, I don't fucking know, you know, whatever kind of story this is.
I don't know. Like, it just the closest that I can think of it is like a Saturday morning cartoon, but I can't tell if I'm just like arriving at that because there was a Mario Saturday morning cartoon, you know?
Yeah. Like, it feels very random. It feels very like, and not to like lull Japan random it.
No,
you
know, no.
But just all the stuff just feels very, you know, oh, it's mushroom, you know, it's a mushroom kingdom. And these guys are made, these are, you know, little tiny nuts.
It just,
if walk around, and then turtles, and it just feels very dartboard.
Yeah. It feels like, if you took a bunch of like children's like picture books and just kind of like ripped them apart and then put them back together, you would get Mario. Yeah. Yeah.
It's a Burroughs cut up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I also didn't know this fact. I learned a lot looking into this. Link's name would have been in that futuristic version related to Hyperlink, which was just kind of a new idea at the time in computers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah.
How that would have aged. So this was also one of the reasons why this got this huge push from Nintendo was that it was going to be the launch game for the Famicom Disk System.
Yeah.
You know, which gave developers more space to work with, more memory, and they wanted a game to show that off.
Yeah.
We never got the Famicom Disk System here.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to adapt this for, you know, our audience, American audiences, and the system that we had, the NES.
Yeah. Cartridges with a much bigger limit on memory and no rewritable portion of the disk for saving. And this is the first cartridge that had battery backup saving. A little watch battery rated for 5 years. They put it in because, you know, the prior way that they would have solved this would have been with passwords, but a password for a game this complex would be off the charts long and complicated. It would have been a terrible thing to enter.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It would have been like Metroid, I feel like.
Okay.
Like, because Metroid is also very complicated.
Yeah.
Has a big world and stuff like that. This doesn't feel appreciably more complicated than Metroid to me.
Mm-hmm.
But those passwords are also odious.
Yeah, I was going to say, you like entering the Metroid passwords, Butterfield?
No, I don't. I just don't. It wasn't like, my understanding of this is they weren't trying to get past the password limitation. You know, it was just another way to do it.
Yeah.
It's not the first game with a battery backup. First, whenever you're talking about early games,
I guess you're dangerous. Right. What was the first one with the battery backup?
It's a Falcom game for a Japanese computer. It was the thing I was referencing earlier.
Okay.
I looked that up earlier today. I can't remember the name of it, but it was an earlier game.
Gotcha. Okay. Thank you for clarifying on that. Yeah.
No worries.
This was also,
I'm not trying to be that guy. I'm trying to save you from that guy.
Yeah, I know. This was an early game that used the memory management controller chip on the NES, which kind of
Jeremy Parrish crashes in a Mr. X to my living room. Just like tackles me in his smart suit. Like,
oh man. But the MMC chip was a way for them to switch between basically separate cartridges within the cartridge very quickly to be able to pull from a bunch of different stuff. Even with those advantages, though, they were still working against a limitation of localization, which is character limits, because Japanese text is denser than English text. More information can be conveyed in fewer characters, so the people who had to localize this had to like solve 5 puzzles at once to try and convey the same information in a much more limited amount of space,
truly making them legends of localization.
Also
worth noting, and this is something I think that I originally found out from Jeremy Parrish, speaking of, as he stalks me throughout my house in his smart little hat, is that the version of this that we actually got is probably more fun than the Famicom disk system version.
Yeah.
Because of load times.
Yeah.
This battery thing ended up being a real godsend
for
making games go by snappier, you know, as opposed to loading off of a disk.
Yeah. Getting into a dungeon and, you know, the way that the dungeons were put together, like, literally all of the dungeons were just one big map. And when you're in a particular dungeon, it is, only showing you, giving you access to a small portion of them. Sometimes, you know, unfortunately shaped, like going in and just having it load that entire thing would have probably just, okay, we're going to wait, as opposed to it being instantaneous.
And even starting the game.
Yeah.
Up. You know, there's the traditional, like the music is a little bit more complicated.
Mm-hmm.
on the Famicom Disk System version, but I listen to them and it's not something where I like have a clear preference.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, either it's not one of those things. Worth noting the music too. This has nothing to do with Dark Souls. The music in this game is great and iconic.
Yep.
And the early, like the not pre-orchestral Zelda music is my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
The soundtracks to Zelda 1, 2, and 3 are just phenomenal.
Yeah. Amazing.
Theme of this is so good. The overworld theme is so good.
We almost didn't get the overworld theme. Koji Kondo wanted to use Ravel's Bolero, which is weird, primarily because of its association with the movie 10 and that sex scene. Mm-hmm. You know,
yep.
Just Demi Moore. There we go.
Yeah, yeah. He's a big fan.
But that was still copyrighted at the time, so they had to scramble and make them one of the most iconic pieces of music in all of video games.
Yeah, it is the sound of adventure.
Yeah,
you know, is the Zelda overworld theme from Zelda 1.
Mm-hmm.
Like if I could rig up. And I could do this, but like smart speakers and stuff that just played that whenever I left my house. Like I would leave my house way more often. It would seem really exciting to go down to the store. Talk about the experience of the game. A lot of times, you know, we're not going to talk about individual screens.
No.
Part of that is because that'd be boring, but part of it is because the encounter design in this game does leave a lot to be desired.
Yeah.
It's not really something that's considered. It's more like you go into a room and there's some guys in there.
Yeah.
You know, this room has four octopuses in it walking back and forth randomly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of a pre-encounter design action RPG.
You start out on the southernmost edge of the world in the center, and you've got three exits mm-hmm. off of the screen, and there's a cave mouth in front of you.
That's so important, like having the multiple exits. It reminds me of Metroid.
It does.
Right? Like Metroid has that very famous opening. And same thing with Mario 1. Like mm-hmm. all three of the Nintendo tentpole games have really, really meaningful opening screens.
Mm-hmm.
Mario 1, you know, you cannot go left and all of the incident is to the right.
Mm-hmm.
And an enemy is coming in from the right that communicates to you. In Metroid, you know, you play that next. You try to go to the right and you can't. So you mm-hmm. try to go left and it gives you a power-up. Let's go to right. That teaches you something. In Zelda 1, the fact that when you open up, you have three different options and there's nothing to suggest that one of them is better than another also communicates something to you.
Mm-hmm. And also the fact that there is one cave door versus three exits off of the edges as well.
Yes.
And it shows you that like these are both different kinds of navigation, you know?
Yep.
Yeah.
There's going to be interior space. Also, you may as well go into this cave because it's the one thing that, you know, you have nothing to help you decide between the other exits.
Mm-hmm.
This is the one thing that calls itself out. It's very elegant.
Yeah. Also like super elegant. You start with no sword. You have to get the sword from the old man in the cave. Like we said, this originally would have been a choice between the sword and the boomerang. But kind of telling you like, you know, your abilities are going to come from other people. You find them in the world as opposed to just starting with them, as part of your character, you know, kind of built into your controller. Right.
Yes. This old man says it's dangerous to go alone. Take this mm-hmm. with a sword, which has wrought all kinds of psychic damage by the fact that I get that in spam emails.
Yep.
Like Priceline will send me a thing that's like, it's dangerous to go alone. Take this deal. And I'm like, fuck you. Don't pander to me.
Go to hell. I'll kill you.
I didn't do shit. I didn't really shit.
It's not even a show.
So the world map has these kind of rough zones to it.
Yeah.
The southern area, which is kind of plains, there are lakes in the middle. East has a kind of a forest.
Mm-hmm.
Southwest also has a forest. There's a cemetery to the west, and then mountains, Death Mountain to the north. That was also here, right, even from the beginning.
Yeah, yeah. That kind of served as a basic template for Hyrule for years to come. We'll talk about the enemies that are kind of endemic to these regions when we go there. Like each of the dungeons is kind of hidden in one of the regions here. Mm-hmm. But as you're heading around whatever direction you go, you do have access to a good amount of stuff like right from the get.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There are money you can get from just these enemies, which you can then use at the merchant that mm-hmm. is in the next screen up.
Yeah.
You want to buy bombs. So those, you know, so you have access to those.
Yep.
You can also walk around and gather heart containers in order to get the next sword upgrade right away.
Mm-hmm.
You can get enough money to buy the magical shield, which is better, and get the blue ring, which gives you higher defense. Yeah. You can do all this stuff before setting foot in a dungeon.
Yeah. Having the magical shield helps because it will block magic attacks. Mm-hmm. Other than that, you only be able to block like Octoroks stones that they spit at you, or, you know, melee attacks.
Yeah. Stones that definitely came from their body.
Yes.
Like Bezoars that they throw at you. This requires grinding for money, which is kind of odious.
Yeah.
One of the big uses of rewind I did when I did this playthrough was to cheat at the gambling game.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't have to do this shit.
Mm-hmm. There are also, you know, like you will find moblins that will give you to say like, hey, here's this. Give, you know, and again, I just had some of these locations memorized, you know, finding 10, 20, 50 rupees at a time. Will again get you ahead of that curve.
Yes. Yeah. The first dungeon is just, there's no hint to getting it. It's just visible on the overworld.
Mm-hmm.
You go across a bridge. It's on this little island to the north. We're going to fight some enemies on the way there. Mm-hmm. Moblins, which you talked about, these are orcs. Basically, they throw spears.
Mm-hmm.
Just some guys. Octoroks, which are octopi that spit mm-hmm. rocks. They're just some guys.
just fucked up little guys.
There's a water guy as mm-hmm. well, who you can't really reach at this point, who will take pot shots at you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then there's the goddamn pea hats. Those flying ghost plants or whatever it is. The depth is not conveyed. There is no shadow.
Yeah. Those are annoying enemies.
Yeah. So this dungeon is shaped like an eagle, at least according to the manual. To me, it looks a little bit more like a genie's lamp. That's what I always saw. But
sure,
you know, I'm just a simple man from Ohio.
Yeah, it's simple man from the Arabian Nights.
Mm-hmm.
You see a lamp, call it out.
Yeah, but this is small, and you're primarily going to see the different kind of rooms, the different things here. The room where you have to move a block to make the door open. The room where you have to kill everything in it to get a key to spawn to open the door, etc. And down the line. And you're getting an introduction to some of the basic kind of less dangerous enemies that you're going to get in the labyrinths down here. And also the mm-hmm. Wallmaster, still one of the scariest things in games.
Yeah. Wallmasters are great. These are gigantic hands that come down and put you back at the front of the dungeon if mm-hmm. they grab you.
Yeah.
Very scary. They make a very scary kind of breathing sound
mm-hmm.
when they're around. One thing that's just very, you know, very special to me as a gamer is how much Zelda 1 is in The Binding of Isaac.
Uh-huh.
Which are everything.
Yes.
Everything in Zelda 1 is also in that game, so there are Wallmasters there as well and stuff. Whereas also we're going to run into slimes.
Yeah.
These little globs.
Yep.
Stuff. What's the Goria?
Goria are like it's the underground moblins that throw boomerangs at you. Will occasionally drop the regular wooden boomerang.
Got you.
Yeah.
Also just moblins.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, dudes.
It is a little bit surprising how weak Stealthos are in this game, especially for how dangerous they would become later. You know, they would eventually, in Ocarina, like even in Link to the Past, they would have, they acted kind of like the Dark Knots, kind of more emergency encounters. And then, of course, everybody's favorite, the Keys, the bats that can fly around, go around obstacles that you cannot.
Yeah. Everything, a lot of the enemies, the flying enemies and the projectiles from the water enemies, the Zolas, move on the diagonal, even though you can only attack on the cardinals.
Yeah.
Which ends up being really interesting, especially in terms of blocking. Like, the reason why keys are interesting is because they can come at you from an angle you can't really attack at.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that little shuffle we talked about, that little quick turn to attack, you're doing that not just to fight Dark Nuts, but you're also doing it to get angles on things that are coming at you from diagonals.
Yeah.
The treasure here or that you get is the bow.
Mm-hmm.
We can't use it yet, though. We have to buy an arrow that converts our money into arrows. We had to buy a license.
It's really funny that you end up getting the toy, but you have to buy the batteries within this game.
Yep.
Yeah, it's sad. Income memory card. Yeah. But you know, regardless of if you buy the arrow, that'll give you projectiles. You're likely going to get your first boomerang from these Gorias. The boomerang is, mm-hmm. Minimally useful, but it is still nice to have a projectile early on before you can reliably have arrows. This will do like a little stun enemies for you so you can get around them.
I use this a lot more than I use the bow and arrow.
Oh,
I got nervous about my money.
Mm, yeah.
Just like using a resource, so I ended up using the boomerang quite a bit. I also just like the sound it makes. It's like very satisfying to me.
Yeah. Something that is weird and will surprise you if you're coming back to this from the later Zelda games is that they don't do the thing where the boss of a dungeon can only be defeated by the item that you found there. Just a dragon here. There is just Aquamentus. He stands at the right and he shoots spread shot fireballs and you kill him with your sword.
Yeah. The bosses in this are disappointing.
Yeah.
Without having that gimmick to them. Like, I think that the hit the boss with the thing you got from the dungeon three times is not particularly inspired in later Zeldas.
Mm-hmm.
Here, a lot of times these felt weirdly tuned to me. I did not move fast enough to get out of the way, and I did not have proper range for them. I'm not saying they were like super challenging or anything. They were just a little bit annoying. Like, mm-hmm. you got cheap shot.
Yeah. Especially when they start reusing them as well. Multi-headed dragon that just, here it is, but with one more head this time. So survive more mandatory damage, buddy. Yeah.
And then the bosses also just show up as regular enemies, which is fine.
Uh-huh.
But it's just not super exciting.
Yes.
When you take him out, you get a heart container. It just shows up in the room.
Yep.
Gotta grab it. Then you grab a Triforce piece, and the game very helpfully just teleports you out.
Yeah.
You don't have to walk your way out of the dungeon, which is really good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And now you are set loose to go look for another dungeon. You can wander into any number of them, but you are meant to go over to the eastern portion of the map to kind of this more maze-like forest and look for the moon dungeon. The path to this is a little bit trickier because, the entrances and exits will lead to exclusive paths,
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of have to follow the outline and, look for these hidden paths.
Titles.
Yeah.
Titles. When you get into this dungeon, which is shaped like a moon, as we mentioned, we get some new enemies. These Moldorms, these little snake guys.
Mm-hmm.
Ropes, which are these also little snake guys?
Yeah, right? Yeah. Like the Moldorms are like big segmented worms. The ropes are like the little cobras.
Yeah, the little bubbas.
Yeah.
And then these little turret statues.
Yeah.
And the treasure here is the magical boomerang. You could have already gotten the regular boomerang. You might have missed it, though.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless of what, you get this upgrade boomerang, which goes all the way across the screen, has better range, and moves a little bit faster, too, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is good. The way the boomerang works is kind of strange because the speed at which you can throw it is determined by whether or not you hit something. So, like, missing mm-hmm. with it, unless you can steer it by moving to a different position, leaves you a little bit vulnerable as you're waiting for it to come back. Yeah.
It's also worth noting, earlier I said that you can only attack on the cardinal directions. Your boomerang you can throw diagonally.
Yeah.
Which is satisfying.
Yeah.
You get a hint here. An old man inside the dungeon says Dodongo dislikes smoke. Again, a classic meme line from this.
Mm-hmm.
This is a hint for the Triceratops you fight at the end of this, Dodongos. who walk around just kind of randomly, again, just vibing, like they're not really doing anything.
Yeah.
You put bombs in front of them and they eat them. and this is them disliking smoke.
Yes.
The bombs do leave a big smoke cloud, but that it is an obscure hint.
Yeah. It's almost like a lateral thinking puzzle or something like that. I was surprised at how detailed the animation was, like how funny it is to watch them gulp these big old bomb balls down. Mm-hmm. But also like, I wasted a bunch of bombs placing them just like slightly off or slightly too far in front of it or slightly too far into it. When they would decide to eat one was not entirely predictable, actually. There's a certain amount of jank to it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not quite there.
Yeah.
We get through this, we're heading towards stage three, Manji. You can get here right away, mm-hmm. if you like. It's west from the start, when you start out. You go into the wood zone over here and east a little bit.
Yeah. When you're headed here, you're likely to run into the Forgotten Woods or the Lost Woods here. You know, which is a big old repeating screen. There's also the Lost Hills, which I forgot about as well, because that's not anything they decided to repeat. But this one, there'll be an old man who will give you the hint, you know, about how to get through this and get to the other side. Otherwise you end up getting lost.
Yes. Amanji is a swastika, just a little bit different.
It's facing the other way.
We talked about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's facing the other way, but still, like, it's not a great symbol.
Yep.
You know, but we just
roll with it.
It's fine.
Yeah.
You know, go back to the Commander Keen episode of WAF.
We did. Yeah, the episode itself where people yelled at us for being, like, weirdly culturally insensitive.
for not loving, you know, I've said it before. It doesn't matter what it meant. you know, it's been colonized.
Yes. You know? So anyway, this stage introduces the Zol, which are the large blobs that'll split into gels. This is going to be mimicked later on with enemies that will split into keys. One of the dynamics that is, you know, like it's kind of random when this is in play. Sometimes enemies will have leaders. Where when you walk in, there will only be one of them visible on a screen, and then more will appear. If you kill the first one that you saw, all of the others will go away. That is something that disappeared. That's a mechanic that went away as the series went on.
Yeah, it's also really weirdly, again, I keep bringing it up just because I have more and more experience with it. They added that to Isaac way late.
Oh, huh.
Like Isaac is still harvesting mechanics from Zelda 1, like even in its later expansions.
Yeah.
It's really strange. Most notably here, we get Darknuts.
Yeah.
Who are the knight enemies you cannot attack from face on. I really like fighting these. I think it's really cool. Mm-hmm. Eventually it gets a little bit tedious, and when the encounter design gets spammy.
Yeah.
With these things, it kind of sucks. Mm-hmm. But early on, they're a fun emergency.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think.
Like very early on here as well, they're also mixing in bubbles with them. I hate the bubbles. These enemies fucking suck.
Yeah, they're obnoxious.
Yeah. These are just like little areas of static that will kind of move around and chase you pretty aggressively. And when they touch you, you are unable to use your sword for a small amount of time, leading to some damage that you can't really avoid.
Yeah, a bummer.
Yeah.
The old man hint that's in this dungeon is, did you get the sword from the old man in the waterfall? All these old men know each other.
they're all the same, like, weird version of, like, MySpace for old men.
Yeah, they all play Canasta. It's this, you know. But that's actually a good hint, you know. Like, you do want to go get that sword.
It's a good sword.
I'm here. The bummer here is you end up doing the thing that I never like in video games, where you get a key that's purely a key.
Yes.
That has no other utility. And this is the raft, which just goes across a couple of very distinct places, mostly to get access to dungeons.
Yeah, you have to launch from a dock. There are very few of them. You know, one of them will get you a heart container. The other one gets you to the next dungeon.
Yeah. The boss here is named Manhandler, which sounds like a cool nickname.
So it sounds like one of the evil American gladiators.
Yeah, Manhandler, or like would be the fourth Salt and Peppa. You know, Salt, Peppa, Spinderella, and Manhandler.
She's the one from Boston. This is it's a four-mouthed round creature. It's almost like a piranha plant kind of deal. Any of the heads that are left will spit fireballs, kind of like roughly in the direction that they're pointing. It's pretty easy to deal with these guys with the bombs.
Yeah. One bomb can take them all out.
Yeah.
If you place it right. We use this raft, as we mentioned, to get a heart container and to get to the Eastmost Peninsula there for the fourth dungeon snake. Eastmost Peninsula gives us the heart container. That was the hint.
Yeah.
On the first dungeon. This is in the Westmost Lake.
Yes.
That we get to.
Yeah.
With the raft.
The one without a bridge, but with the dock.
Yeah.
Yeah. Around here, like maybe there have been one or two darkened rooms before. This is the stage where they really start kind of throwing them at you. So it's worth throwing them at you frequently. So I think it's worth talking about them. This is weird. Anything with the candle in this is the candle is unique to this game, and it feels strange to have this little menu tax where when you step into a stage, you use this item to leave a little flame that will brighten it up. You can see the enemies, but you cannot see where there are like water or lava gaps that you can't navigate. So if you are trying to fight blind, what will often happen is you get stuck. The enemies will, you know, because their AI can get around there, they can access you and hit you.
They bully you.
Yeah.
Is there a candle in Zelda 2?
Oh, I forget.
One in Zelda 2.
There's a torch that you get relatively early on that will light up some of the screens, but I think it's I don't know if it is coded as a candle.
It is coded as a candle.
Okay.
I was 90% certain about that. Sorry. I was just
okay. No, that's yeah.
It's just they got rid of this mechanic, which is good because it's an annoying inventory tax.
Yeah.
You just have to go switch to your candle, light it up, and then switch back to whatever your preferred secondary weapon is.
Yeah.
It's also specifically you're using your candle that you bought from stores that can only be used once per room, and that's a huge bummer.
Yeah.
Eventually you get one that is not thus restricted.
Yeah.
You get the power up for it, but pretty obnoxious.
Mm-hmm. Old man hints here, tells you like walk into the waterfall. I don't know what is that pointing to on the world map?
There's a secret. There's a waterfall you can walk into up in the mountains.
Gotcha.
It might be, it's not the guy who gives you the note to give to the old lady.
Yeah.
Maybe it's the guy who gives you the note to give to the old lady. It's something.
Yeah.
I know where it's weird. Like I can't remember exactly what's there, but I remember mm-hmm. where it's at.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like it's in the upper right. And if we're portion of the map,
if it's in the upper right, it's probably the old man with the license to sell you the water of life. Yeah.
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 Who, gives you the MySpace password to go into the weird old man connect.
Yep. The new one of the new enemies here is the Vire. This is the demon that splits into multiple keys and mm-hmm. the like-likes. And as I was playing this, I realized, oh, getting hit by a like-like is kind of the original Basilisk curse.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Big bummer. You lose your shield.
Mm-hmm. Can't like block. Yeah. And then you gotta like take a hike. You gotta walk somewhere yep. and then buy another shield.
It's real tedious.
It is.
it's really obnoxious. Like I actually don't like it very much as a mechanic in this.
Yeah.
Because it's just a time tax.
Mm-hmm.
But we get the stepladder here, which lets you cross one block wide gaps of water. Really useful for those dark rooms. Mm-hmm. In general, which I think that's why they introduced the dark rooms here, is to kind of give you an antidote for it.
Yeah.
If you don't want to get out your candle.
Yeah.
And the boss is a Gliok, another dragon, this one with multiple heads. Every time we run into this, it's going to have more heads. The heads kind of move around a little bit randomly.
Mm-hmm.
You have to hit them in the head.
Yeah.
This guy is also fairly difficult, especially once you don't have full health and you have to get up close to him.
Yeah. Yeah, when you're close enough, he doesn't stop shooting fireballs. It feels like you just kind of have to take mandatory damage and then just outrace him, which is a bummer.
Yeah. Next stage, Lizard is the next dungeon.
Mm-hmm.
We can have the ladder. Now with the ladder, we can go get the red bracelet, which is another little bit of damage protection.
Mm-hmm. Or the red bracelet is the one that lets you move or push the boulders.
Yeah, push blocks. You're right. Yeah, because it's a ring. Rings are the thing because it's before tunics.
Yes.
For armor, you're right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
you can get the
magic sword.
Yeah, the most powerful sword, the magic sword, which will double your damage on that. Pretty important as we're gonna start kind of fighting more of the which ones are the tougher ones? The blue ones. The blue variant of enemies are tougher.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
And notably, this is not the Master Sword.
Right.
Predates such.
Yeah. So the Lizard Stage is up in the Northwestern Mountains. One of the easiest ways to get here is to use the very limited warp room that you can find. That'll put you right next to this. It's a little tunnel. It's a little cave full of tunnels that'll take you to different places. You're going to start running into Lynels or Lynels up here. How do you say that? Lynel or Lynel?
I always say Lynel.
Yeah.
Here is how I call them.
Yeah. These are centaurs who shoot like little blade arms at you. And they're very tough.
And they're tough. It's not quite as tough as they end up being.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things I like about Breath of the Wild is turning these guys into like really exciting monsters later.
Yeah.
So this is a big dungeon. This is the first one that starts getting a little bit tedious. Mm-hmm. This is also the one where the old man shows up and goes, I bet you'd like to carry more bombs, wouldn't you, you piece of shit.
Look at this asshole only carrying 8 bombs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You bet right, numbnuts. Like this condescending prick. Yeah. I hate him so much.
So you can buy with him, that'll reduce the amount of trips that you need to make, you know, to run away with your tail between your legs to buy more bombs. The other hint here, they say Dig Dogger hates certain kinds of sound. There's also another one that says secret power is said to be in the arrow, which is a hint for way later on.
Yeah. Yeah. Dig Dogger sounds like, he's played by Danny McBride. Doesn't Dig Dogger sound like that?
Yeah, yeah. It's a guy who just, his first inclination when he steps into a room is to take charge.
Yeah, like a real shit kicker.
Dig Dogger is a walking emergency. Yeah.
The enemy here introduces something called Pole's Voice or Pole's Vice. Here, which are these little rabbit guys. Mm-hmm. This is really interesting. On the Famicom disk system, mm-hmm. you kill them by using the microphone that's built into the computer.
Yeah, built into the controller. Yeah.
Yeah. Because they have sensitive hearing. Obviously, we don't have a controller with a microphone in it, which I'm actually fine with. Like, what a silly feature. but here we have to actually just fight them. So some of the hints and the things in the manual are just straight up false.
Yeah. Yeah. So it says like, yeah, loud noises because they've got those big old ears. Instead, their weaknesses, they go down very quickly to arrows, fighting them like up close. Yeah. they're little wimps, can't handle their arrows. Fighting them up close is pretty difficult because they do have that kind of random hopping, kind of motion that they do. Getting close is a little tough. And also they introduced the Gibdo here, the mummies, which take just a shitload of slashes to kill.
Yes. Something that was improved upon later entries where they made them vulnerable to fire.
Yes.
Like a mummy might be. Mm-hmm. The item you get here is a whistle, which is like a hybrid between a key and a useful item. Mm-hmm. It's a key, but it's like an interesting key.
Yeah.
Here it ends up giving you a kind of fast travel. It gives you access to a lake that gets drained. It will kill certain enemies. Mm-hmm. Specifically the boss of this, the Dig Dogger, who is this kind of weird eyeball monster.
Yeah,
a little bit. Yeah. You have to use the flute on him mm-hmm. in order to break him into smaller bits you can take care of.
Stage 6 is a dragon. This one is found in the graveyard. You probably have been wandering around in here. I like how this is desaturated. Like everything here is gray and dark blue, mm-hmm. which is pretty neat. And you're going to be dealing with the Genii. These are the ghosts that will spawn when you touch the headstones.
And more troublingly, Wizrobes.
God, I hate them.
Yeah, these things suck. They turn invisible. They teleport. They're dickheads.
Yeah, those blue ones. They're really obnoxious. They fill so many rooms with so many blue Wizrobes, and they're always paired with bubbles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's, again, they're really grasping for encounter design in this game a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, trying to figure out, like, what is an interesting mix-up. And the bubble is just a force multiplier. Like, that is something, a way that you make any mix-up more complicated.
Yeah.
It just doesn't do it in that interesting of a way. Mm-hmm. You know, taking away my main verb and making me do a timeout to dodge could potentially be interesting in a game with like more dodge possibilities and where enemies didn't move randomly and teleport.
Yeah. Also, yeah. I mean, I'm going to say there's no way to kill a bubble, and somebody will say, actually, you can if you stand at the edge of the map, etc. In this one, there's no obvious way to take them off the board. You just kind of have to walk around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And again, it's very rare that you go to a room where killing the enemies is optional.
Right.
One of the other things I think is kind of gets in the way, you know, great for 1986, not a big, not a huge deal, still very revolutionary, but kind of annoying in modern hands is the idea that so many rooms are, you know, eat your vegetables and then you can leave.
Yeah.
You know, I, doors locking and making you kill everything before you can leave is a video game trope that I've always found very obnoxious.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very frequent here.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. The item that you get in this dungeon is the magic wand. This is mm-hmm. kind of a companion to the, or counterpart, let's say, to the bow and arrow. This is an infinite use projectile. Lets you shoot the yep. same projectile that, that the wizard robes do.
And starts a fire where it hits.
It starts the fire with the when you get the magic book later on.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You have to upgrade it.
Yeah.
And eventually it becomes a fire projectile as well, which is really good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Old Man Hints tells you to aim at the eyes of Goma and also gives you a really important hint for where to get to the next dungeon. Says there are secrets where fairies don't live.
Yes, which is playing the flute at a lake mm-hmm. where there are no fairies,
yeah.
Which is pretty obscure. Goma is a crab. Grabulon, who only opens his eyes every once in a while. You have to shoot it with the bow when yep. his eye is open. Difficult, but not too bad.
Yeah.
Like, fairly, you know, pretty cool boss for this game.
Mm-hmm. Nice trick. It's one they would do later on. And it's neat to see it presented pretty much as is here on the first go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. This next dungeon, Demon, we go here through that lake, as we mentioned. There's actually a kind of a, there's an item you can get called bait in this game where you can buy it.
Mm-hmm.
It will make enemies go to it when you, you know, leave it kind of like a trap, but you actually have to use it here.
Yeah.
A moblin holds you hostage basically and will not let you continue until you give him some food.
Right. Like green tentacle.
Yes. Very green tentacle-esque. And then you no longer get bait.
Yeah.
You only have a certain number of slots in your inventory thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of upgrade. Like, it's interesting the way they use that space.
Yeah.
You know, you have the wand and then you get the book and it takes up the place of that inventory.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, mm-hmm. Nothing really special in this dungeon. It's big. There are a lot of little mini bosses in it, but we've seen all these enemies.
Yeah.
Here. Useful that you get the red candle here because you can use it multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
And the flame hangs around. You don't, no longer, if you're searching for secrets, have to like do the shuffle back and forth between the scene between two screens.
Something about the flame, like, you know, so as you get the ability to use this multiple times on the screen, you're probably going to start trying to use it as a weapon. Flame will hang around for a little bit. You need to be sure not to walk directly into it. It is a way for you to deal damage to yourself.
Yeah. Whereas bombs are not. Right. You don't hurt yourself with bombs, which is really interesting
mm-hmm.
In this game.
Yeah.
I mean, it never happened to me. Maybe if you're right on top of it, you do.
Possibly.
But you can walk right up to the wall and put the bomb in there.
Yeah.
So.
I don't remember it being a problem. Please don't yell at me. I don't remember it being a problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. Old Man Hints here will tell you where to find the boss. It says the secret is in the tip of the nose. You know, and this is telling you, hey, look at the shape of the look at the shape of this. It's kind of like if you picture like a Pac-Man, you know, mm-hmm. you want to go up to the tip, like in the very, very far northeast. Maybe that will be the nose of this. You got to go.
It doesn't really look like a demon.
No, it doesn't.
There's actually a huge thing that we neglected to talk about that people are probably screaming at us about.
Okay.
Which is maps and compasses.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Every dungeon, you don't have the map of that initially and you don't know where the boss is. You have to find the map to get the shape of the dungeon and the compass.
Yes.
To point out where the boss will be.
Yeah.
Here. So when we were talking about how you could find secrets by kind of intuiting the outline of the dungeon shape, you have to find the map before you can do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So each dungeon is not just like making a beeline for the treasure.
Mm-hmm.
That's in it.
I apologize for that omission.
It's okay.
Yeah.
No worries. I forgot about it too.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, but you got to go up to the tip here. You've got to kill 5 wall masters. So you will have enough time, to push a block. If you don't, then you're going to be grabbed and then carried back to the entrance, which is as far away as possible from this.
Yeah. Really tedious.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then when you get to the boss, it's just Aquamantis again.
Hey, bud. Good to see you. Still kicking around this town, huh?
Yeah. Level 8 or dungeon 8 is called Lion.
Mm-hmm.
This is really hidden. This is the one that's under a bush.
Yep.
That you have to burn. That's rough.
Yeah.
You know, and there's no hints for this either, as far as I know. Like, you just kind of have to know.
You just have to look and see, like, oh, there's really no other path that's blocked by just one bush. They're kind of just they're kind of always like either like out in the middle, or they are stacked next to each other, forming the walls of a particular screen.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is a bit of a leap.
Yep. When you get here, there are no new enemies as well. Like, the game has kind of run out of new stuff to show you. Generally, it's just blue whiz robes and dark nuts, so it's a real pain in the ass.
Yeah, dark nuts for days.
And yep, this is where you get that magic book that gives your wand firepower.
Yeah, ended up relying on that wand quite a bit. It's a good weapon.
Yeah, it's really good. I like it a lot as well. You also get the magical key here, which is really cool. Which is a key that is never used up. So you no longer have to, you know, worry about your key economy.
Mm-hmm. Outright necessary for Death Mountain. Yes. I just, with how big that is, I could not see doing that while having to deal with key limits and stuff.
Ugh. It'd be very annoying. Like, yeah. Death Mountain's a pretty annoying dungeon.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The hint we get here, they tell you how to get to Death Mountain in an oblique way. He says Spectacle Rock is the entrance to death.
Yeah.
It just sounds really foreboding. I don't know what entrance to death and why I'd want it.
Why would I go there? Yeah. Thank you, sir. I will steer clear of death.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then the boss is just another Gleok. This time has four heads.
Yeah.
So, yeah. We're in diminishing return zone.
We are.
At this point.
Yeah. And nowhere are the returns more diminished than when you head to Death Mountain, going up, fighting right past the Lynels and past the falling boulders, to get to a screen that has, just kind of like two circular, like mountain boulder kind of deals. Mm-hmm. You have to use your bond to blow open the leftmost eye, to get into this, gigantic, dungeon, which effectively has a bit of a teleporter maze kind of effect to it. Where you go through the secret stairways, and there are whole like sectors of the dungeon that are that are off limits to you until you get through there. You know, go through those secret stairways. It's not really clear what the linkage will be when you go through those, and you cannot tell by looking at the map. I want to get to that northeastern portion. I don't go northeast. I instead go over to this little room over here, and that's how I get up there.
Yeah. Yeah. And before you actually get the map, it's a huge pain in the ass because you don't really know. You know where you are in space, but not what it really means.
Yeah.
You know? This dungeon, I think, is obnoxious.
Yeah.
We didn't talk about it, but when you go through that waterfall and you get the letter, which you give the old lady for health potions, that is kind of, you know, your Estus.
Yeah.
You know, in this game, to put it in Dark Souls terms. But you can only carry one. That's not great.
Yeah,
like that's tough, and it makes this dungeon really obnoxious because as you get further into it, you know, it's a real endurance test.
Yeah,
we talked about that in the beginning of the episode as kind of a, you know, a highlight of you know, hey, this dungeon's gonna be longer. You're gonna have to be longer away from civilization. Mm-hmm. You can't really outfit for it.
No,
you know.
Yeah, so. The best you can do is, you know, get your rings. You know, just do as best as you can to be able to kill stuff quickly and take less damage from the attacks that they do, and then buy the expensive potion, which gives you two uses. But there's that's all you got. This feels like it is designed to take multiple trips.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, there's like there are tough enemies here. There like are upgraded versions of the Moldorm called Lanmola, which show up in a few different places. And then the Patra, which are these, it's like an eye that has a swarm of little eye bugs around it. And you cannot deal any damage to the center, until you kill the rapidly moving like ring of eyes around it. And
like a gyroscope.
Yeah. It's visually impressive. Like, it's kind of neat. Yeah. There's like a faux 3D effect to it. But the fact that the ring can get bigger and move, just kind of makes it so that it can do damage, a lot of damage to you whenever it wants to, as you are trying to very delicately, perform the attacks on the outer eyes to get into the center one.
Yeah. It's not quite, I felt like this enemy would have been better if it had been stepped up a little bit. Like, if it started off with rings at a static distance out, like the early ones, and then later ones would have this motion.
Mm-hmm.
Two treasures here. The red ring, which it halves your damage. Again, you know, quarters it effectively. And then the silver arrow, which is just a key that we need for Ganon. And Ganon sucks.
Yep.
He teleports around. He turns invisible, shooting fireballs at you at oblique angles. You have to hit him with your sword until he turns red, and then you have to hit him with an arrow.
Yeah. and then you're done. The invisible yeah. and teleport the invisible teleporting enemy. It's way too many hats on this guy. Way too many irritating boss fight things piled on.
Yeah. I would go as far as to say I don't love the Zelda fight or the Ganon fight in very many Zelda games.
No,
even Link to the Past, which I really love. Like, it's not like that's a huge highlight or anything.
No.
But yeah, once you get through this, you walk into the next room. There are fires around Zelda, which you put out with your sword and rescue her.
Yeah.
And she's not going to notice you, bro. And finally, peace returns to Hyrule.
Yes. You know, she holds up her Triforce. You have your Triforce. And Ganon's, it is presumed, went away with him. So you're done.
Almost like an orange fog gate thing. You cannot enter this dungeon if you don't have the rest of the Triforce.
Yes.
You actually get a special message, which I'd never seen before. I just found out through research. Because mm-hmm. When I was young, I didn't stumble upon this. I had to be told where it was after I'd done the rest of the dungeons. Mm-hmm. You get a little thing that says you have to go back and do the rest of the game.
You're early.
So, yeah, kind of neat.
Yeah.
That's The Legend of Zelda, which again stands up really well, feels very forward thinking, despite some of the back half being a little bit obnoxious.
Yeah, some of those doldrums that I think stick out, if you are playing it, in a kind of back-to-back kind of fashion, right?
Yeah. Really good, more Dark Souls-y than, again, the question isn't really why are we doing this on the show, it's why haven't we already done it?
Right.
It's got a lot of DNA to it.
What a couple of young fools.
Oh, gosh.
Okay, I'm sorry I misgendered you constantly during that.
Yeah, sorry I used the wrong name. I think that I had drank a Buzz Ball right before that.
Have you seen the Buzz Ball XLs? They're like beach balls.
No. Isn't that just They're a party so ball?
Yeah, it's bigger than a party ball. There's like a Buzz Ball, a party ball, and then there's like a ER ball. that they sell it at Plant Pantry, and it's just so funny to see just a bunch of like dangerous and kind of enticing neon orbs at the convenience store.
Oh my gosh, I need to know what the Everett 40 Hands equivalent of that is, like the incredibly poorly thought out drinking game with the Buzz Ball XL.
Like you roll it back and forth or something.
Yeah,
like the Earth Ball in gym.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to that episode. Thank you for supporting us. If you do, again, patreon.com/duckfeedtv, ratings and reviews, things like that. If you're any kind of marginalized person and you have a project or product you'd like us to shout out, please send me an email at gary@duckfeed.tv. Include relevant information. This episode, I want to shout out a podcast, a biweekly comics podcast called Bite Me Fanboy. Primarily queer ladies on it. I don't think it's entirely, but it doesn't have to be. And this is like kind of a book club. They read and react to famous or infamous comics, graphic novels, manhwa, or manga. Make jokes about it. So if you think it's going to be irreverent, it's not. It's irreverent. It is two people who are new to comics and two comics experts. Questions like, why is Batman like that?
Okay.
So this is anywhere podcasts are sold. The link they gave me is the RSS thing, but if you search it, Bite Me Fanboy, you'll find it. RSS.com/podcast/bitemefanboy with dashes between bite me and fanboy. So check it out.
You don't see that kind of breadth across all of those, talking about American stuff and manhwa. Yeah,
manhwa you never see. Yeah. My only experience with manhwa is that horrible Resident Evil thing that I couldn't read. I'm sure there's better stuff than that, but it's literally the only manhwa I've tried to read, and it made me want to die. So this would be a good way for me to find stuff that didn't make me want to die.
I don't think novels are really great for me. I read this one,
Yeah.
I read a pamphlet from the instruction manual for my dryer.
Yeah. I'm not really into prose.
Yeah.
Anywho, check it out. And if you have anything else like that, shoot me an email. Mm-hmm. And we will see you next week. If you have things to say about
The Legend of Zelda, I mean, there's no reason not to take some responses about it. A lot of people have played and know that game. The deadline for responses for everything in January is January the 15th. That is going to be Zelda. Now you have me saying everything to
the Binding of Isaac.
The Binding of Isaac. There we go. Thief 2. The Metal Age, and the premium episode is RoboCop Rogue City. And the deadline for February stuff, which is Mortal Kombat 2, Mega Man X4, and Indiana Jones and the Great Circle. That deadline is February the 15th at duckfeed.tv/contact.
Yeah, keep your responses concise and specific.
Keep them concise and specific,
and we'd be happy to read them.
I think that's everything. I won't see you next week, but Gary will.
Until next time, watch out for Blue Candle.